Technorama interview with Scott Sigler.
Good morning, folks. This is your captain speaking.
Technorama.
Remember when?
Technorama.
On this day in tech history.
Tech.
And now, the news.
Tech.
What the chuck?
Technorama.
Welcome to Blockhead Video.
A woman named Marie just came through here looking for her children. Did you see which way they went?
Over there, in the media corner.
Technorama.
Hold my beer and watch this.
Unfasten your seatbelts and disregard all safety rules. Here your flight crew, Chuck and Craig.
Welcome to Technorama, the show that takes a lighthearted look at tech, science, sci-fi, and all things geek. If this is your first time listening to Technorama, thank you for joining us. If you're a returning listener, welcome back. We appreciate you giving us your time. I'm Chuck Tomasi, and with me as always is Craig Stepp. How are you, Craig?
I'm good, but I'm kind of scared to get in the shower.
Yeah, stories like this and authors like this will do that to you.
That's right.
This time we've got a staple in the podcast community who has gone on to bigger things, but he hasn't forgotten his roots. We have with us author Scott Sigler. Welcome to the show, Scott. Hey, for the two people that don't know you, tell us about yourself. Who's Scott Sigler?
I am a fiction author, and I put out two lines of books, one with Crown Random House, and those are hardcover thrillers that are out in all the stores. That's Infected, Contagious, Ancestor, and the one that just came out, Nocturnal. And then my business partner, A. Kovacs, and I also run Dark Overlord Media, which puts out a series of young adult books, which is a pro football league 700 years in the future with aliens playing positions based on their physiology. And that is the Galactic Football League series, for which we just recently signed a distribution deal. And those will be in store in paperback form on August 7th.
Ooh, very cool. Very cool.
It does
I
sound
also
cool.
Podcast and record all my stories and give them away as free serialized unabridged audiobooks every Sunday at scottsigler.com.
That's an interesting segue because you started in the podosphere in 2004, 2005 and started giving this stuff away to build that audience. And it worked so effectively that it led to the publishing deals, if I got that right.
That's correct. I was giving everything away, still giving everything away, and that built up an audience. You know, it's a combination of exposure and availability of things being online, easily shared, free. People will click on it to see what happens. And then the caliber of the content was enough to keep a lot of those people around as long-term fans. And then when I put out a book called Ancestor from an indie publisher in Canada, the book was number one in horror, number one in sci-fi, and Amazon.com. And this is pre-ebook. This is before all the ebook craziness, and it wasn't 99 cents and it wasn't free, and we sold enough copies to be number one for about 3 or 4 days, and that caught the attention of the big publishing houses in New York, and then they went into a little bit of an auction to sign me. So I signed with Crown, and that deal came about specifically because I'd given everything away, as you said, and built an audience. And then when I told that audience, it would be great if you guys could go buy this book. Now that I've been giving things away free for 3 years, they went out and bought it, and the rest of it worked out well.
All right. Now, I know you've been podcasting as longer than we have. Are you still finding a value at giving the material away? Is it fueling your success continuing?
I still think there's an enormous value in it. However, it's now gotten to the point where we have to think to the future and make some decisions. It's not the value of giving the content away. It's weighing that against the time it takes to put it all together. And there's two factors to that. Number one, the ebook revolution has come around and just changed publishing forever. So the amount of time I spend recording an audiobook and doing the podcast for that audiobook, could that time be better served somewhere else, creating more ebooks to get into the store? Because the ebook consumption is exponentially higher than anything the podcasting's ever going to do. But the other part of that is, now over at scottsigler.com/store and on Amazon and other places, we sell all the audiobooks that I've recorded. So all these podcasts that I've done, we've either edited them and put them together as one big audiobook, or we've just re-recorded them. And now at $20 a pop, people can download these 40 and 50 hour audiobooks. And that becomes a great profit center for Dark Overlord Media. So since we're going to record them anyways and sell them as full audiobooks, once the recording's done, that's the big chunk of time. So right. as long as we're recording audiobooks, we'll continue to chop them up and give them away as free podcasts.
Are you recording those audiobooks, or is somebody else doing those for you?
So far, I've recorded all the audiobooks for all the novels that have come out under my name.
I thought this was kind of funny. You know, I started seeing all these book trailers. I know you and Hutchins and some other people have been doing it. Is this like a thing now? Do books always have trailers?
Book trailers are getting to be more of a thing. They have been around at least since 2008, it was 2007, when I put out Ancestor in print. First thing we did was do a book trailer for it. And it's getting to be more popular because of the persistence of YouTube. So anything that you can put up on YouTube will have permanent exposure value for you. Every day, it's going to get a few more views. And the Infected trailer, which has been up for 4 years now, still gets anywhere from 30 to 50 views a day. Some of those views are from people who know my work. Some of them are from people who've never heard of me and just stumble on it based on how YouTube works. And out of some of those people, they're going to see it and go, man, I got to read that book. And then they go buy it. And then you've got a customer and hopefully a lifelong fan. So sure. you will see more of it. Because just the longevity of it, there is nothing else that you can do as far as marketing a book goes that has that kind of permanent value to it. I just came out with Nocturnal and Crown ran some advertising on Goodreads and a little bit on Boing Boing, and those ads were there and then they were gone. But I went and paid to do the trailer myself, and that trailer's at 45,000 views and still going, and that's in a month. And it will just continue to crank out views for as long as it's up there. So it, you know, that will pay. That will continue to keep bringing in viewers and bringing in money. Hopefully,
sure.
So your latest book to hit hardcover is Nocturnal. Tell us about Nocturnal, because I loved that as an audiobook, and I can't wait to dig into it in print.
Well, you're really going to enjoy the print read because it's been polished up and changed dramatically from the podcast version, but it is still the bones of the story are still the same. And it's following the story of two San Francisco homicide detectives who are on the trail of a really brutal serial killer. And one of the detectives, Brian Clouser, is having dreams about these murders. And then when they go to work the next day and go to a crime scene, he's finding that the murders match his dreams exactly. And he goes from being a decorated cop to a prime suspect in this very quickly. And then it turns into... it's a buddy cop slash police procedural that runs headlong into a modern monster story. There's a giant cover-up that the police department has been involved in for centuries. There is a secret cult, and there is a genetic variant on humanity that is behind all of this stuff. And as the book kind of hurtles along towards a really big summer blockbuster movie-type ending, you see the potential for the city by the bay to be awash in a giant bloodbath where just everybody gets killed. So I describe it as Lethal Weapon meets Hellboy, and that description seems to resonate with the people who've read it.
So this is a part of your young adult series. I'm just kidding.
This is part of the young adult series. Yes, absolutely.
Children's bedtime stories.
We start the children's section with the evisceration on page 16. And then wrap it up pretty much with the decapitations on about page 300. So,
well, I did tell you to put out a coloring book with Infected or something like that.
I can make a coloring book, but you only need one crayon. If you get a red crayon,
one crayon.
Craig, well, I had the pleasure of meeting up with Scott in early April out in Arizona. He was doing a book signing and things at
Changing
Hands. That's what it is. Yes, thank you. Uh-huh. And, halfway through the read, this baby starts crying in the back and has to be carried out. And I think Eva said, you know, there's one of your recent reviews or they just read Nocturnal.
Yeah.
That's good timing.
Yep. Poor. Yep. Some of the book readings are interesting because my stuff is really graphic and kind of hardcore. And invariably, for some reason, the reading area is always near the children's section. So I've gotten, you know, you go from the absolute freedom of the podcast, where I used to open up the podcast with the very friendly line, if you're easily offended, turn it off now, pussy. And that was kind of like, if you don't like this stuff, don't send me a friggin' email and complain about it. Just don't listen. It's easy.
That's right. Yeah.
But when you're in a bookstore and there's a mom shopping with two of her kids, you got to kind of on the fly edit stuff.
People are looking at each other. That's not in the book. That's not the way it was.
I now when I do a reading now, I tell people where what page to turn to in their hymnal so they can read along.
There you go.
And you can see the laughter in the audience when I get to a word that I'm swapping out on the fly. They find that quite entertaining.
So now I know you go on these tours because last year at Dragon Con, I remember you were leaving there to immediately go on your trip. And I saw on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, you know, you going to all these places. What are your tours like? Do you have I guess you got a plan, of course, ahead of time. How's that all work?
Well, my biz partner, Ian Kovacs, plans these things out for me. I'm not so good with the logistics side of things. But basically, these are just get in the van punk rock tours, except we're reading books instead of playing music. I mean, it's down and dirty. If we can drive, we can connect four cities with one rental car, we'll do that. You know, we try every day. We're trying to do a tour stop because we can't afford a day off because it's very expensive putting these tours together. Because if it's a music tour or like a Nerdist podcast tour, for example, you can sell tickets and you can at least offset the cost of what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But what we're doing is we're asking people to buy books from the bookstore, and most of those books, I'll never see any of that money ever. So it's completely self-funded. So we try and cram as often as we can, and we'll go to one town. I'll do the reading. Then part of the culture of my fan base is I go to the bar with all the fans after, and we'll hang out for several hours. Then I'll go to the hotel, go to sleep, get up, drive the next day, and I'll probably sleep in the car while someone else drives me to the next tour stop. We eat on the way. We've got a cooler of food. We don't stop for restaurants or anything. We just go from one town to the next. Our record is we did, I think, 23 towns in 26 days for the rookie tailgate tour.
Wow. Yeah.
And that was fun, but since we've learned to break it up. So I just did 9 cities in the West Coast tour for Nocturnal. Then in September, we're going to do the East Coast side of that and add in another 10 cities in 11 days. So we'll just plow through everything. They're pretty fun. You know, we get anywhere from 50 to 100 people out to these things. Everybody really enjoys going out to the bar after. And it's a mixture of people who've been listening to me since 2005 and where I feel like one of their friends and kind of part of the family because I'm talking to them every week.
Sure.
And brand new people who've never seen anything. And the brand new people are just astounded that the author's like, come on, we're all going to the bar together. And they get to go out.
Yeah. Do you always get that feeling like people have trouble getting you at first? Like, I don't know.
Understanding that.
The feeling I get is the people who really gravitate towards my style of fiction in the podcast, what they have trouble getting is that I'm actually for real. They're almost like, I swear, it's almost like this is kind of too good to be true. There can't be a guy who tells these kind of stories
from the
and isn't preaching in my face or giving me the left or the right or trying to be all, you know, trying to shove his politics down my throat in one way or another. Is just telling this rip snort of a tale and then is perfectly willing to, you know, go have beers after, that kind of a thing. People seem to have difficulty believing that that's for real. They think it's kind of a character. And then when they get a chance to hang out, they understand that that's just the way things are. So
yeah, if they knew your characters, they wouldn't think that.
Well, let's talk about the basis of that. What is your inspiration, Scott? Where do you draw from?
Well, the biggest inspiration for me continues to be Stephen King, old Stephen King,
mm-hmm.
because that's the stuff I was reading when I was in the sixth grade and junior high, and I read a ton. I read a ton in junior high and high school, and I read all kinds of stuff, but very few books would actually, you know, get me emotionally and draw me into the story. And Stephen King, of course, is the master of that. And so I would read him a lot, and the lessons learned from reading those things and the emotional reactions I have from reading his books stay with me now as a creator, because that's what I want to do to other people. And so that's a big source. Another giant source is Jack London, who was kind of the original adventure writer. And his cutthroat, very wild stories really riveted me as a kid. And also, he was the first person I read that would base an entire book through the perspective of an animal. And you could tell that he was working very hard, like, I know I have to communicate in English, but let's try and make this as animalistic as possible. And that opened up my eyes to a different way of storytelling, that you could tell stories from many different perspectives and you didn't have to follow one character through. Everything didn't have to be a typical detective novel where reader finds out same time the detective finds out. So those two guys were probably the biggest, they had the biggest impact on me when I was deciding that I wanted to be a writer and that's what I wanted to do for a living.
Well, you can see that animal perspective in Ancestor clearly.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of Jack London in Ancestor. I mean, it's a frozen Arctic island and there you're getting the point of view of the animals and trying hard to portray things from the animals' side of things, perspective of things, so that even though it's the monster, if I'm doing it correctly, you should not know who you want to live, the monster or the person. You should be conflicted by that. And the real influence for trying to make those conflicting situations where there is no right answer is actually Battlestar Galactica, which has had a pretty lasting impact on the more recent one on my storytelling. And then the other ones are Michael Crichton and Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child, who wrote a book called Relic. Those three people were very educational for me in realizing I can write a story that's jam-packed with science and has a ton of actual real-world facts in it and still scare the crap out of people. You don't have to do supernatural vampires and ghosts and goblins, and those things are great. I'm just not that interested in those, so following those three writers to realize, yeah, you can use actual real science to make your monsters, those guys kind of finished off the direction in which I write.
Gilroy 2.0 is here. Gilroy 2.0 is everywhere. Gilroy 2.0 commands that you listen to Technorama. Do you comply?
How much real science did you do? I mean, I'm researching some of these books. I mean, there was a lot of science in Ancestor, for example, but tell us about your research that you do for these things.
Well, the research is really extensive, and that's the biggest challenge I face is trying to research it correctly, get the information into the book, communicate it so it's believable and plausible, but not drown the reader in a bunch of science, because they're not buying my books to get educated, they're buying my books to get entertained. If I can sneak a little education in there, a little science knowledge, that's fun, and people usually like that. But I mean, I'm telling a thriller story that has a scientific bedrock to it. So I will come up with a concept, and then I will send those concepts to my science consultants. I have two PhDs and a research MD that go, they love it. They have such a good time. They go over everything, and then I'll get feedback from them. And then comes the really dicey part where I have to take what they've told me and hammer out an outline. And then that outline will go to my editor, and the editor's job is the other side of the perspective, like boring, boring, this part's good, boring, get rid of this. Can you do something different here? And the editor will hammer out the outline, and then it starts all over again. Then I do a new outline and I start writing. And as I get to the scientific parts, I farm out to my science guys. Like today I've sent, probably five emails, one to a naval sub commander that I know for the submarine parts, one to an Air Force major I went to high school with, two to the research guys, and one to a guy who flies helicopters for the Air Force. So because of the podcast, I get a lot of people who've sent me emails saying, I appreciate the detail you put into these things. By the way, I do this. If you ever need a consultant for this thing right here, get a hold of me. And I file all those guys away in my address book. And when I get to, let's see, I need particle physics. I don't know anything about it. I don't want to read the book. And I'm not going to spend a week educating myself in the basics of this because that's not what I get paid to do. So I will email the particle physics guy and say, I kind of want to do this. Does this make sense? And then he will come back and say yes, or he'll say no, and you could do this. And then we pound. It's just like, you know, the analogy is you watch those guys making swords in on TV in the old medieval videos. You got this giant lump of molten metal and you just keep hammering it and cooling it and heating it and pounding it in its shape till you finally get something at the end that people want to see.
you know, when I was searching around on the internet for looking for, you know, anything to talk about, you know, all things Scott Stigler, I saw your name come up beside some interesting stuff like Thomas Kincaid. I don't know. I'm not sure about why that was there. Or, and I saw that.
I'm a painter of light, sir. I paint with light.
No, you're a painter of dark.
Yes, I'm a painter of dark. Thank you very much. I'm feeling that.
There you go. And I saw this one article. I don't know how you fit in here, but it was John McCain jokes about President Obama eating his son's dog. So, but it started making me think, where actually do you fit in? I mean, were you an awkward kid in school, or were you jock what?
I was half jock, half nerd. I was playing D&D from, like, I think the fourth grade or something like that. And all of my lifelong buddies were all in my D&D group. You know, the guy who married me, the guy who performed the wedding ceremony was in the D&D group. My best man was in the group. So those guys all were all my childhood. And I was a very spastic kid and really hyper. And a total dork, but I never realized that I was a dork. So I'm sure there was some general butt of the joke things going on that I just never got. And I was also pretty funny. So I kind of circumvented any nerd-related beatings through that. Mm-hmm. And then I also played sports, which in a small town in northern Michigan, that's a really big deal. So right from freshman year, I was playing football. And if you're on the football team, that's a different social structure for at least in the Michigan culture that matters, even though you're not any good, you don't actually play in the games. And then, but my dad was the football coach, so that helped a lot too. Mm-hmm. But not really very awkward, really sharp in class, horrible attention span, terrible. I was just an asshole to my teachers because I was always arguing with them. No matter what they had to say, I took the opposite point and I argued it. But then my junior year, our school finally got wrestling, and wrestling was the first time that I was able to compete against guys who are my own size. And I was, you know, I wrestled at 126 pounds, and that's not very big if you want to play football. When I was a freshman, I weighed 98 pounds playing football.
You were the football.
I was. Oh, I got the crap.
Quick, throw Stigler.
And guys would just tee off on me, and I was, you know, I was slow and fast and not very strong and small. So that, but then once wrestling came around, it was a major impact on my life because all of a sudden I was a bad MF and I could go out there and beat the crap out of people. So at the end of high school, I was playing D&D literally every weekend and writing stories and the captain of the wrestling team and just kind of covering a bunch of different areas, and I never really found an identity in any one of them. And then ever since high school, I've been focused on, I want to write books for a living and doing that.
All right, Scott, you got to be honest with this one. You've written 600 pages. Your editor sends back a ton of edits. Mm-hmm. Be honest. What goes through your mind at that point?
Absolute despair. And where is the scotch is usually what goes through my mind. This happened with Nocturnal. Nocturnal, I did the podcast, and people loved it. They loved the story. So I'm trying to select what will be my fourth book for Crown. I'm like, you know what? I'll just do Nocturnal. It's already done. Like, this will be a first draft, right? So I give the first draft a read, and it's 225,000 words, which roughly translates into maybe a 750-page, 800-page hardcover novel. And I send it into Crown. And the editor does exactly what you just said. I got a 28-page single-spaced letter back outlining everything that was wrong with it.
What's wrong with you people?
And it was a weird letter because basically it was 26 pages of me getting my ass kicked. And then interspersed in there were little lines like, but don't throw all of this out because this is really good. And I did. I got the letter. I read the first paragraph, and I took the letter straight to a bar here in San Francisco called Edinburgh Castle, and ordered scotch and just started reading through the thing. And I was writing Nocturnal was the worst experience of my professional career, and probably will always be, because I had done such a massive amount of work. And then he was like, okay, this is awesome, but this isn't even close to being ready for prime time, and we gotta monkey around with this. And then it's a thriller structure. So, you know, A leads to B leads to C leads to D. So every time you pull out B, it breaks everything after it.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
constantly reworking and constantly reshuffling and trying to make things come together. And then as you make things come together, you write new stuff, and then you're like, oh, here's my favorite 25,000 word scene. It's just got to go. It doesn't fit anymore. So you wrote all that for nothing. So finally got it done, and people really are really digging the hardcover even more than the podcast. So it's totally worth it. My editor did an absolutely amazing job, but it was really, really tough. Really tough.
Yeah, I was going to ask, how's the sales going?
Sales seem to be going pretty good. It's it got out of the gate pretty good, and now it slows down as things always do when you're in your fifth week. But there seems to be a little bit of momentum building up on the back end. So with most of my stuff, I get sales that are pretty far below like the top 10 New York Times bestsellers. Like I'm not even in that ballpark, but what'll happen is as the book plugs along a year from now, I will still be selling 2, 3, 4 times as many copies a week as 99% of the books that came out at the same time as Nocturnal. And that's probably due to the podcast and being online and spreading word of mouth that way. So mm-hmm. I don't have a major amount of sales out of the gate, but the longevity of the books is something that's really exciting to the publisher and that the publisher is still trying to figure out. And I keep explaining to them because I give stuff away free as a podcast. This doesn't take much to figure out, dude. It's yeah. We're out getting fans, new fans every week. And if you give something away for free and then people listen to it and like it, they are so enamored with you that you had the cojones to be like, yeah, it's that good. I'm going to give it to you for free and you're going to wind up giving me money anyways. And people love that swagger and they love the fact that they got the choice to decide if it was worth their money or not. And when you give people that choice, they just go out and buy everything that you've got. And then people send me pictures of their Sigler bookshelf with everything on it. So kind of works out. So it works out really well. And that's the other reason that podcasts will probably continue.
Have you seen any other current authors getting it? I mean, or old school authors, rather? You know, they go, oh, and they start getting on Twitter and Facebook and putting out stuff for free and all that.
Well, there's definitely some authors who are out doing a great job on Twitter. I mean, Neil Gaiman is
mm-hmm. oh yeah,
kind of the hog at the trough right now in the genre world. And he's got a million plus on Twitter. So those people are out there. And then you've got guys like John Green, who's a YA author who's a New York Times bestseller because he vlogs. He started out, he's always been a writer, but he had a show called, The Vlog Brothers or Brothership 2.0, in which he and his brother decided to communicate for a year only via YouTube videos back and forth.
Oh, that's cool.
It's cool. It caught on and blew up. And now they have a gigantic, I mean, they put out a video and it's like 250, 300,000 views. And they've got this really active community. So when he comes out with a new book, it's like, bam, you know, they're selling 50, 60,000 copies right out of the gate. So there are people, there are old guarders like Neil Gaiman who get it. More so new people who have come up with social media, and social media is even the reason they are bestsellers in the first place. But as far as the really old guard, not so much. You know, you're not going to see Stephen King do it because he doesn't have to.
Yeah.
There's no reason for him to take the time to do it unless he really enjoys it, which is odd for Stephen King because he's been the first adopter of just about everything when you go back to his career. He's been way ahead of the curve.
Ebooks. He was one of the first authors really make an ebook and offer out there, wasn't it?
He was an early ebook guy. He did the first Kindle only book. You know, I mean, when I say first guy, I mean the first established author to do these things.
Yes.
His Green Mile, the bringing back serialization, The Mist, doing audiobooks. He's done just a ton of stuff. So he's been very cutting edge. So clearly he's just not interested in it. So the old guard, at least what old guard I know of, they're not that into it. And you do get people who do it horribly wrong. Like, I'm 90% sure that Anne Rice's tweets are not her own. So she's got someone tweeting for her, which is still a communication channel to her fans, and I'm sure that's great, but it's never going to catch on the way Neil Gaiman does when it's obvious that Neil's the one doing the tweeting. So people do get it, and people are using it, and aspiring authors and lower-level mid-list authors are getting it more and more and more. Guys are really working to be... Yeah, they've got to have a website, got to be online, got to be interacting with the audience. It's a very important part of everything.
Yeah, it's better than just interacting with them when I come out with a new book, you know. That's the only time you see them when they come out of their hole.
Yeah, and sometimes people will come out of their hole in the, you know, the old days, you would come out of your hole for a book and you would do a radio tour and you'd be on all the radio stations, you'd be on morning talk shows, and there would be newspaper articles and reviews about you. And now what people, unless you are Stephen King or Neil Gaiman, you come out with your book and there's crickets because there's no more venues in which to promote the book. I mean, you either get covered in the LA Times book review, the New York Times book review, or your local media covers you, or there's absolutely nothing. So now those venues are gone, and people have to find a way to get out and interact with their audience.
Technorama, the podcast for geeks, because geeks are better than cool. You don't hear someone say, "Get away from me, you cool person." Who's gonna have their 65-inch home theater system installed by the cool squad? Not me, that's for sure. How much cool cred do you have? Not enough to care about. Think you'll find any canned unicorn meat at thinkcool.com? It's just a part domain name. They don't even have roadkill in a paper cup. That's why you need to start listening to Technorama, because that's what geeks do. Go to chuckchat.com and listen to Technorama before you turn cool.
Tell us about your fans. You have a really cool name for them, in case those two people that we mentioned earlier in the show don't know about this.
My fans are called the Junkies, and the reason for that is the first podcast novel I put out was called Earthcore, and it was only available as a podcast. The first release of this book was a serialized audiobook. And that was the early, early days of podcasting, when the only people doing it were T. Morris with Moravi and Mark Jeffrey with The Pocket and The Pendant. And I was doing Earthcore, which wasn't available in print. The other guys were available in print. We're using the podcast to sell their print books, and it worked really well for them. I had a weird reaction with Earthcore because I didn't have a book in print. I didn't have a print deal. So I'm like, I'll just give this away, see how it goes. But it was about the time of Lost and the early 24s, and it had this a similar reaction, which is you would listen to an episode and then wait to see what would happen, and you would have to wait a week to get the next episode. And the first episode had like 3 listeners, but by the 10th, they were up in the 10,000 range, and people were finding it every day and listening to 10, 11, 12 episodes, getting caught all the way up in a hurry, then waiting to see the next episode, then only then understanding they would have to wait each week for the rest of it. So they started to call it Earthcrack, waiting to get their fix of Earthcrack, and then one of the fans referred to each other as junkies, and I stole that. I'm like, that's it. I'm taking that right there.
Yeah.
So they've been junkies ever since. And, you know, I still get wonderful emails from people who will discover me out of the blue and have never heard of me. And then they'll just read through everything or listen through everything or a combination of both. And then I'll get an email once they run out of stuff, because if people discover me today, there's literally like you could listen to an hour a day and have, you know, like a year's worth of content every day to listen to.
All Scott all day.
But then they run out and they're like, what do you mean there's no more? And then they email me and tell me to get off my dead ass and write something. And then they talk about how they're junkies now. So it's really cool.
Well, besides the horror genre material, what do you read? And the internet is not an answer.
I don't read very much, which is very disappointing that I don't, because you really need to do that to keep your chops up. And, you know, you never know when you're reading. You'll find a little device that somebody uses and be like, that's cool. And it's everything, you know, from grammatical, the way sentences, interjections in Lord of the Flies by William Golding, or, you know, you can read Misery, which will not by Stephen King. Not the same story as an ebook, not the same story as an audiobook, because in the print book, he does a lot of games with typography to connotate to connote different emotions and reactions, and it's impossible to reproduce that any other way but to see it on the page. So when you read books, you see these stylistic things, and you see a turn of a phrase, and you get all of these cool. You're like, you get excited. You're a kid in the candy store again. I don't read very much because I'm busy. Writing books and podcasting and recording audiobooks, and we're trying to get some video stuff off the ground now to capitalize on that phenomenon, and just don't read all that much. Right now I am reading Leviathan Wakes by James S.A. Corey, and it's a super long book, and I hope to finish it sometime in the next month.
And these are hypothetical questions. So if you were elected president, what would be the first thing you'd do?
He fell off. If I was elected
president, I think the first thing I would do is have a State of the Union where, number one, Congress is not allowed to applaud and stand up and interrupt crap every 5 minutes. And number two, that you would give an actual, like, yeah, here's the way things actually are. And I'm not going to just blow sunshine up your ass so I'll get reelected. I'm very down on the current political situation. The left is ridiculous. The right is ridiculous. And we're getting no communication going whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So probably term limits would be the first thing that I would push for in Congress and try and do something to improve the horrible rhetoric that we have going. Like, you're not going to agree, I'm not going to agree, we have to have a compromise. That's why it's called politics. It's all about finding the best solution that satisfies the most people, not being a giant douchebag, whatever side of the fence that you are on. So I would have a douchebag rule as president.
Okay. All right.
I got to ask you, have you counted how many times Minion Fogarty, a.k.a. Grammar Girl, has referenced you?
No, but I hope it's a lot more.
It seems like every other week she's talking about your writing style or some...
She's done, you know, I being a self-funded guy for the most part, you can't count on the publisher to do any promotion for you, so you're on your own. You got to be creative. And social media, there are so many personalities that are just gigantic that... And people in the regular publishing or advertising world have never heard of. And there's a lot of people who've never heard of her. Mm-hmm. And have no idea the audience that she commands online. So she's a friend of mine, but I understand she's got a show and she's got an audience to satisfy. So I'll go to her and say, hey, how about we do this? How about you take this chapter and you can talk about sentence fragments, since that's a big part of my style. And then she can go in and just do whatever she wants. She can tear it apart. She can say they're good, say they're bad. So I'm helping her get some unique content that's fun for her audience, because it's not just a random grammar question. Like, here's a book that's actually in stores by a New York Times bestseller, and we're going to kick him in the nuts. You know, it's...
Well, the sentence fragments is the one I was just thinking about, because that was recently.
Yeah. So I've done two of those episodes, I believe, with her, and she's been really wonderful to do that. And I don't know whether it works or not. I don't know if it's ever sold any books, but I'm a big believer in advertising and repetition. And my goal has always been, with all this online stuff, I'm trying to create a buzz for my name so that people will run across my name two or three times, maybe in relation to John McCain and Barack Obama's dog. I don't know. But then if they're ever in a bookstore or they're in the Kindle store and they see a book cover with my name on it, you know, something clicks and it gets them to go look at that book and examine it. And like all things product marketing based, all you're looking for is for the consumer to take a look at your product and see if that product is what they actually want, see if it's worth their money. But that'll never happen if they don't know about you. So things like Grammar Girl and getting in front of a lot of people who would never pick my book up by chance ever, you know, 3, 4, 5 years from now, they've heard of me a bunch of times. They're in a bookstore, like, oh, screw it, I'll give this a try. I've heard of this. And so that's what you're going for.
Yeah, you'll never see Stephen King on Grammar Girl.
No, probably not. It's a hard thing to look at. But you might see, an Anne Rice on Grammar Girl. Anne Rice's sales are still awesome, but not what they used to be. Maybe she'll look around for a way to reinvent her name. You know, the people mm-hmm. in Hollywood and TV are really, really good at it, at reinventing themselves. And every mm-hmm. 5 years, they kind of got a different take on things. They're masterful at it. And in the book world, people are not that good at it. Because once you've written 5 or 6 books in a specific genre and you've been a bestseller, even the big hitters, you know, like Jim Butcher, you branch off and do something else and you don't really have that same level of success. So mm-hmm. you'll see more people coming into the social media world. The best example of that is Chris Hardwick and the Nerdist podcast, which is, you know, him and Adam Carolla. And Joe Rogan, those guys are probably the biggest podcasts out there, period. And if you look at who Chris Hardwick had on his podcast in the early days, two and 3 years ago, it was established stand-up comedians and guys who were his buddies and guys he had toured with and a couple of actors that maybe you've heard of them. Oh, I know.
It was people I was going, how did he get them?
It was like, oh, yeah, I've seen those movies. And now it's this endless parade of an A-list. And you know, now he's at the point now where you know, expect the next Charlize Theron movie to come out, she's going to go on his show to promote it. So mm-hmm. big media is understanding the reach and the buzz and the humanization you can get. When you're on the Nerdist podcast, you know, you are not a filthy rich film star anymore. You're just a regular creator who's out making something cool that you hope people like. And it changes people's perception of you overnight. So you will see a lot more of it. And eventually you will see Stephen King starting to do more of these things.
So Scott, what's next for you? What's on the calendar coming up?
Our calendar is ridiculous this year. We just put out Nocturnal, and then we have the Galactic Football League series, which is the young adult sports crime series. And we have a print deal with Diversion Books and Perseus Distribution. And we're going to be in Barnes & Noble and Hudson Books. And these are books I gave away free as podcasts. And mm-hmm. now it's come all the way around to where A and I are the publishers. We're actually paying for all the print costs ourselves. And these books are going to be put out in stores. So The Rookie and The Starter will be in stores August 7th. And then books 3 and 4, which are the All-Pro and the MVP, will be in stores December 7th. And we're hoping for a very Merry Christmas at Dark Overlord Media, because these are the kind of things that people will buy. Oh, my kid's into sports, but he doesn't really like to read. Here you go. Or my kid's a geek and he doesn't really like to read. Both sides of the coin, you know, we've got that covered. So we've got something really awesome positioned for regular bookstore retail as we come into the holiday season. So that's exciting. My first graphic novelization is out from IDW Publishing, which is a comic book company that does Joe Hill and Teenage Ninja Turtles and a bunch of other books. And a graphic novel of Infected, and drawn by Chad Minshew, and that's going to be out in May. So that's really exciting, because a lot of times the graphic novel is the vehicle to get a movie made, because in Hollywood, you put a graphic novel in front of them, they can read over that at lunch and instantly get the idea for the movie, as opposed to slugging through a 400-page hardcover novel. Mm-hmm. So that's exciting. A and I are putting out ebooks. A lot of the stuff I've podcast for free is now coming out as ebooks, short story collections, one called Bones Are White, another called Fire Is Orange, and then The Crypt, which is a gigantic hard SF military story that's in my Siglerverse timeline, and those are going to be out as ebooks later on in the year. And I'm sure there's a couple other things that I'm forgetting, but we're putting out something like 12 different things this year, and we are doing everything we can to take advantage of this revolution in the world of publishing, where I can sell ebooks and I don't have to give up 88% of everything I make to somebody else.
Yeah.
We can take 70% and share 30% with iTunes and 30% or 30% with Amazon. And they're making money, we're making money, fans get books they like faster and cheaper, and everybody wins except big publishing.
Ding.
you mentioned tour dates. Do you have any on the East Coast? Do you have any of those dates set or cities that you'll be visiting?
So we start off August 31st at Dragon Con in Atlanta. And then we are September 4th in Raleigh, September 5th in Washington, D.C., September 6th in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, then New York City on September 7th, September 8th in Pittsburgh, September 9th in Chicago, and September 10th I finish up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, where my family is from. And people can see details on those over at scottsigler.com/tour. But all my books are at scottsigler.com/store, or just go to scottsigler.com. We've got a Facebook group link. You can follow me on Twitter there, which is at Scott Sigler. YouTube feed. Just subscribe to the free podcast via one click from iTunes and get the stuff every week for free. So that's really the best place to go and get caught up on everything that I have.
Oh, it's been great having you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you guys for having me on. I appreciate it.
Once again, thank you, Scott, for joining us, and thank you for listening. We appreciate your support. If you like the show, there are many ways to show your love. You can call the listener line at 206-222-CHAT. That's 206-222-2428. Or you can email us, technorama@chuckchat.com. Follow us on Twitter, C. Tomasi, Step K, Technorama. You know the links. They're all over there at chuckchat.com. You know, a review on iTunes would be nice, too. Show your love there. It's free. It takes about 30 seconds.
I dare
you. We would like to see you on Google Plus on Sunday night, so you can see our regular show all raw and wriggly and unformatted and everything before it gets through the sausage machine.
It's like it just was born.
Just circle Technorama Podcast, Craig or me, and you'll see an announcement when we join the hangout. This show is a proud member of Friends in Tech. You can find out more at friendsintech.com. We're also affiliated with the shows over at farpointmedia.com. Until next time, tell a friend about Technorama, and as always, a binary high five.
101.
That was so terrible, I think you gave me cancer.